Refuse to shine.
Conservative flashing down the street, pointing their plastic finger at me. They'll pursue my kind of drop and dive, but I'm gonna wave my green flag.
Me to die, so let me live my life the way I want to. There. Sing on, brother. Play on.
Thanks for listening to great speeches and interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. If you're just joining us, we're continuing with Occupy the Courts, a conversation with Lawrence Lessig and Chris Hedges. Lawrence Lessig and Chris Hedges met in front of Occupy's TV NY's camera to discuss their vision of change.
Now, I don't think a convention, you know, one of the fundamental view position I have about this reform movement is that there's two things happening at the same that have to happen at the same time. One thing is, as somebody from the left, I celebrate the leftist reform movements that are reviving themselves and to get expression in the Occupy movement. And I think all of those are extremely important. We haven't had those enough. Maybe 1950 is a mark. I don't know when it is, but it's sometime in a long time. And they have to become powerful and really vibrant again. But at the same time, I think we have to recognize, at least in the conventional way that I'm talking about, and I don't mean convention there, I mean the conventional way that I'm talking about, one faction never achieves fundamental reform. We have to find a way to talk about fundamental reform that isn't just about one faction. And so at this is kind of bizarre, it's kind of odd to see whether it's even possible, but can we put two things together at the same time? One is a revival of this leftist movement and a recognition that the leftist movement might need to find not common ground, but a common enemy. So it might need to be an alliance in the sense that you could imagine somebody like a Stalin sitting with a Roosevelt against a common alliance, against a common enemy. And that's what I wonder here. I wonder whether there isn't a grassroots movement that could express its anger about this corruption clearly and forcefully enough that it didn't have to get in, that this part of it didn't have to get into, you know, whether once we fix the system we're going to have progressive taxes or no taxes. And in my view, that's the only hope to affecting a constitutional change. Now, maybe we'll just, you know, some people just want to get rid of it. Let's have a real revolution, have a new government, that's the end of this constitution. I'm not there. You know, that's not my game, but I understand it.
Do you think that, I mean, Professor Lessig said this is the only path for inserting change in our system. I've like quoted that right. Do you think that's right?
No, I think that the only path left is civil disobedience.
And I've seen that I'll just expand on that then, because you brought it up, and I've seen you write that. What can you define what is the scope of civil disobedience as you understand it?
Well, mass acts that defy the law of the land in a nonviolent way. I don't think that... I mean, I'd be curious to hear sort of the nuts and bolts of Professor Lessing's idea of how it would work. I think that the state has played its hand, and when it shut down the 18 Occupy encampments, that if it had any capacity to hear the voices of the people, Congress only has a 9% approval rating, so most Americans absolutely detest everything that they're doing. It doesn't make any difference. You know, nobody supported the FISA Reform Act. 80% of Democrats supported a public option, and yet Obama scuttled it and turned Obamacare over to lobbyists who wrote it, and it ended up being $400 billion in subsidies to the pharmaceutical insurance industry. I mean, you know, it's just there's sort of an endless train of examples that the legislative process just does not respond, even when the vast majority of the Americans want something, and it doesn't matter, it's not relevant. So I think we also have to bring in the environmental crisis. We just have very, very little time left, and the fossil fuel industry is killing us, quite literally. It's, of course, killing the planet. How do you break the back of ExxonMobil? We're not going to do it through this process, because ExxonMobil owns this process.
Yeah, I think I'm not convinced. I think that you have to. We should avoid either or. I think these two things have to happen at the same time. I'll confess to a certain cowardice about you know, that's brought about by a recognition of the absolute, absolutely extraordinary power that is deployed against civil disobedience in our country. You know, like when Israel had 300,000 people marching, the police officers around those marchers had no guns. They just were police officers there to keep the peace. And you look at the Oakland events, and you know, it's like a military invasion from a Star Wars episode, right? It's like extraordinary. And the unrepentant display of force, embraced by everybody. You know, it's like, well, this is what... And in fact, the polling then, seeing, you know, the American public back away from support because of the conflict of violence, makes me fearful that running down the path that would force that kind of confrontation would lead to, first of all, an extraordinary amount of blood, and number two, it's not clear what the thing on the other side is. So I'm happy to run down the path of more and more pressure as much as we can get. But we live in a, you know, not
how,
just...
How do you exert it? If you don't use the kinds of obstructionist tactics that the Occupy movement, I think, has used successfully, and of course they want us to be afraid. I mean, that's the whole point. And it's not fun. And I just spent all morning in court after being arrested in Goldman Sachs, and going to jail is more time than I care to donate to the U.S. government, frankly, to quote Wendell Berry. But I don't really see that we have any option left, and certainly Bill McKibben agrees with that. Berry, who occupied the governor's office in Kentucky over mountaintop removal, agrees with that. Cornel West agrees with that. I want to know how are we going to bring that pressure if we are not willing to put our bodies on the line.
Yeah, but again, I'm not saying don't put your bodies on the line. I am saying let's not put bodies on the line that we can see predictably is going to produce, you know, tanks on the other side. Because, you know, countries can be brought to being the Chinese very quickly, and our country is very close to being the Chinese in a sense, very quickly. So I want these movements to create that kind of pressure. But I think we also have to open up a release valve on the other side, which is a way to imagine creating a situation where people don't actually need to be in the streets in the same way.
But what would that look like? I don't understand how it would work.
Well, so if there were at the same time that there's these Occupy movements, the Occupy movements pushing for the thing which Washington fears the most, a convention, so going to legislatures. And there are a lot of relatively sane, you know, not at the center of corporate power legislatures. For example, New Hampshire has 400 legislators, right? These are not people who spend much time with lobbyists because nobody can afford to. Okay, so you begin this process of pushing towards the convention-like reform, and what I imagine happens is what happened 100 years ago, literally exactly 100 years ago, when the last time we came close to a convention, calling for the election of senators, because the Senate at the time was conceived to be the source of all corruption inside of government. We came within one vote, and Congress very quickly sent an amendment out to get the senators as elected because they didn't want to see the convention. So the convention is a peaceful form of terrorism here that would really shake up, you know, and I think that that should be on the table as much as, you know, reviving in the spring Occupy movements.
Well, everything should be on the table. On the other hand, I think I have a darker view of the systems of power. I think they're so calcified and so corrupt. And I think that there's pretty good evidence that a lot of these corporations are just harvesting the country. They know it's over. They're grabbing as much as fast as they can, including looting the U.S. Treasury, on the way out the door. I think there's a really deep cynicism. Of course, nurtured at places like Harvard Business School. I think they get it. I mean, they probably wouldn't disagree with our analysis at all. And yet we have no mechanisms now to stop them. There is no way to vote against the interests of Goldman Sachs. Obama has proved utterly useless in terms of curbing these class of speculators who are using taxpayer dollars to reinflate the bubble all over again and make themselves as much money as they can before it crashes. I mean, it's really quite staggering.
No, the failure of reform is the biggest signal that the system is totally corrupt. I mean, it's one thing to imagine the buying of deregulation before 2008.
Right.
But what should terrify everybody, even, you know, conservatives, is the fact that after this crisis, for the first time in American history, the government didn't have the power to respond to real reform. Yeah, so, but we don't have, you know, we haven't actually liquidated a difference in our views about the probability of succeeding on the second path or on the first path. Because again, my view is even if I think this other path is zero probability of succeeding, I still think it's a path that we have to push.
Right, well, you know, in the end, it's a kind of moral imperative.
Yeah.
And if you, I covered all the revolutions in Eastern Europe, East Germany, Czechoslovakia, Romania, spent every night with Václav Havel and the Magic Lantern. And I think that that's how we have to think of it, that this is morally where we have to be. Because, I mean, literally these corporations, which have commodified everything, human labor, the natural world, will exploit them until collapse or exhaustion.
Yeah, but the difference is that when those political cultures collapsed, the people at the top just literally didn't have the resources to fight. And it wasn't bloody. I mean, it's
right.
kind of amazing how little blood there was in that extraordinary
right.
change. But if the same thing happened here, there's a lot of money at the top.
But I think that the whole tactic of the Occupy movement is to not attack the pillars of the establishment, but divide them. To you know, constantly remind the blue uniform police that they are not the 1%.
Yeah.
And that when you create these divisions within the pillars, I mean, the fact that Occupy essentially realizes that the corporate media is not going to, I mean, this kind of a discussion is never going to make it, even on MSNBC, which is just serves the Democratic Party the way Fox serves the lunatic fringe of the Republican Party.
Not as well.
Not as well. And so they just create their own media. That the pepper spraying of the students at UC Davis or the pepper spraying of the women in New York by Anthony Bologna, which were monumental in galvanizing not only support for the movement but revulsion at the tactics used against this movement, came out of the media that the Occupy movement created.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the more that they create parallel structures, they not only show the outside world another way to form interactions, social and even political interactions through the GA and everything else, but they create fissures within the pillars of the establishment. And you know, I was in Leipzig for all of the demonstrations before the wall came down, and there was a moment when the ruler of East Germany, Erich Honecker, sent down an elite paratroop division. It was a night there were 70,000 marchers in Leipzig, and because he realized that as these numbers grew, it was only by using draconian force that he had any chance of regaining control, and they wouldn't fire on the crowd. And at that moment, it's over. I mean, people forget that the Russian Revolution was a peaceful event. It was the Bolsheviks who carried out a coup d'état. But it was when the Cossacks and the elite units went to Petrograd
sure.
and refused to fire on the crowds that it was finished. And I think that that very much is part of the brilliance of the Occupy movement, of creating those divisions between the sort of white-shirted inspectors and the rank and file within the police. And I think that that is the way to go. And that is most dangerous to the power elite.
Just to bring it back to your proposal, in terms of, Chris was talking about Occupy creating parallel structures, other ways to interact with each other and to govern, you know, groups of people. I mean, you're talking about working within, you know, there's a provision in the Constitution that allows people to change the structure of it. Does that, and you say we could work on multiple fronts, but would that, like, draw energy off from this other type of activity?
I don't know why it has to, because that type of activity wants to find ways to express its effectiveness, and this is one way to express its effectiveness. You know, I think that the Occupy movement, I don't purport to speak or even understand, but the Occupy movement doesn't want to become the Tea Party in the sense they don't want to become quickly aligned with a whole bunch of inside Washington lobbyists on our side of the issue as opposed to, you know, the other side of the issue. But I think that there is a real value in demonstrating you know, the way in which these alternative structures restructure society. And one way in which they do this is by beginning to exercise control over the government that the government itself doesn't control. I mean, that is a quite extraordinary thing. We've never done it, right? So what if we did it? What would that mean? The inspiration of the Occupy, there's an extraordinary thing happening in Vermont right now where Vermont is pushing, people are pushing for a convention resolution in Vermont coming from the Occupy movement. But nobody... None of the real leaders there are people who are, you know, intense. They're people who are intense in the inspiration that this has caused. So I agree, it's about reframing power, but let's talk about all the places reframed power can have an effect. And maybe there's a 0.01% chance that it has an effect in this path, but it's worth it. It's worth it.
Of course it's worth it. Yeah.
It seems like you sort of have different approaches but have come around to saying, well, all approaches are good.
Well, not all approaches are good. I would say all approaches that seek to delegitimize the centers of power are good and useful, and we need a multiplicity of approaches, as I think we're both in agreement upon. And sitting around wringing our hands about whether they're going to succeed or not before we try is a waste of time. Right. We should just try. If it doesn't work, we'll try something else.
Right.
And do you, and that, would you agree that anything that sort of is destabilized in the sort of central concentration of power is useful? Would you accept that as a way of thinking about your project?
Yeah, well, my focus is on the particular concentration of power inside the Beltway of Washington that destroys all sorts of social possibility and that's the thing I want to destabilize first. Of course, that does a lot for what happens down here in downtown New York, too. So that's a consequence of destabilizing that power. But I have a sequence, and that's where I want to start.
I guess I have just one last question, and it's a little unfair because it probably calls for a long answer. But destabilizing that power first seems to call for a movement of such a size that maybe it wouldn't really be interested in the end project of reforming electoral politics into the current system.
You know, actually, I don't think that's true. You know, one of the most interesting consequences of Citizens United is that these people who used to be the barons of Washington, the incumbents, are all of a sudden the vassals of Washington, because they are so terrified of this independent expenditures coming in and dropping on their campaign 30 days out. And the only way they can avoid the destruction is to run to a super PAC on their own side and get insurance. And how do you get insurance? You pay for it in advance. And how do you pay for it in advance? You vote and do exactly what that super PAC wants you to do, so that when the bombs drop, they have the reason to come in and support you. So all of a sudden, and I saw Evan Bayh talk about this, and it was just struck me, like, obvious, right? All of a sudden, these guys, who used to be the most important people, are just one more set of vassals inside of this power structure, in exactly the way Chris was describing it. The real power has been shown, and these guys don't have it. And they don't like it. Like, they don't want to be in Washington as, you know, it's bad enough to have to be raising money all the time, but if you really aren't the power, and you can't even hide it to yourself anymore, then they're going to want something different. So I think that this is not stable. It's not a stable equilibrium the way it was before Citizens United. Before Citizens United, it was stable. These guys just had the power. They liked it. And they played games with corporate power or whoever had to play games with. But they don't play it. They don't like this anymore. So I understand the sense in which taking on the king sounds like the wrong thing to do. How you take it on is extremely important. But this is a moment, this is more the French Revolution moment. This is a moment when everything is falling apart at the same time. And I think there's a reason to be pushing on every front at the same time.
Well, thank you guys both so much. I hope that you will continue to talk to each other today and maybe challenge each other a little bit.
You can listen to great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
Virgil Kane is my name, and I drove on the Danville train till so much cavalry came and tore up the tracks again. In the winter of 65, we were hungry, just barely alive. I took the train to Richmond that fell. It was a time I remember oh so well. There goes the Robert E. Lee. Now I don't mind, I'm chopping wood, and I don't care if the money's no good. Just take what you need and leave the rest. But they should never have taken the very best.
They drove old Dixie down,
and all the bells were ringing. The working man. And like my brother before me, I took a rebel stand. Well, he was just 18, proud and brave, but a Yankee laid him in his grave. I swear by the blood below my feet, you can't raise the cane back up when it's in the feed. The night they drove old Dixie down, and all the bells were ringing. The night they drove old Dixie down, and all the people were singing. They went,
and now for something completely different.